The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program from a very wet and rainy Northern California location. I hope all of you are doing fine, staying well, and ready for an excellent Space Show discussion on the subject of space solar power. More about that in just a minute. Our toll-free number this morning, 1-866-687-7223. So please do remember there are no call screeners. Be patient, let it ring, and I will bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. Also, if you're calling during the break, I do answer the phone during the break and put you on hold. So don't let an upcoming break stop you from using our toll-free number. Again, 1-866-687-7223. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also post comments on our blog if that works better for you, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. And this program today on Sunday is the first one listed. Our guest is Dr. Paul Jaffe, who we'll introduce in just a second. So open that page up, scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see a place for comments. And as soon as you post your comment or question, I'll get a copy of it, and I can bring it up on air. But once again, remember, we're a talk show, so we do prefer that you talk with us. So the toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. Our newsletter for the week is already posted at thespaceshow.com, so go to the upper right of the homepage, and you'll see the website newsletter. Be sure to scroll down, and you'll see all of the programs we have planned between now and into the second quarter of 2020. Remember that everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or quickly download shows because our file size is not very large. Upper left, there are a couple of important menu items. One is Listen Live. This tells you how to listen to the live broadcast like we're doing now. Podcast, and we're on almost all applications for Android format as well as for the Apple format. And in addition, they're compressed MP3s on our website in case you want to listen just off of our website or download the program from our website. We also do have a Space Show store if you're interested in T-shirts, logo wear, and things of that nature. The easiest way to access our store is to find the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show on all of our website pages, and Pepper will take you into our Cafe Press Space Show logo wear store. One other quick thing before going further into the program for today. We are a listener-supported 501c3 nonprofit, and we bring you these programs because many of you do support us financially, and we appreciate that support. So if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. There is a large PayPal button at the top of every one of our website pages. That is the easiest way to support the Space Show. But for those of you not wanting to do so electronically, you can certainly make checks out to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation and mail them to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920, as 1GiantLeapFoundation.org is our parent of the Space Show and is the 501c3. And we certainly do appreciate your support. And then remember, we also have sponsors. And the sponsors get that banner ad going across the homepage, which they can change whenever they want. And then on full shows like we're doing today at 90 minutes, during the intermission between the first and second segment, I will read our short sponsor messages. If you are interested in being a sponsor, we have a few places left for 2020. And email me for details, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So at the request of many, many Space Show listeners, the show today is for you because I have heard and I have acted, and fortunately our guest positively responded. So this is about space solar power. We are most fortunate to have Dr. Paul Jaffe with us. He's an electronics engineer, researcher, and integration and testing section head with in excess of 25 years of experience at the U.S. Naval Research Lab. And he has held or led many major roles in dozens of space missions and breakthrough technology. You can read all about this on the blog because we do have his bio uploaded to the Space Show website. But he has also served as coordinator and editor of the NRL Space Solar Study Report and was a PI for a groundbreaking space solar research effort. And we're going to talk about what he's been doing with the Naval Research Lab and space solar power. And it is a great honor and privilege to be able to have Dr. Jaffe with us today. Dr. Jaffe, welcome to the Space Show. Thank you very much for your time and for being here.
David, it's an honor and a pleasure to be on. I've wanted to come on for a while, and I'm glad to have the opportunity.
Introduce us to your space solar power work with NRL, the Naval Research Lab.
Certainly. Well, let me give you a sort of quick historical sketch about how we got where we are today. I suspect a number of your listeners will be familiar with the study that came out in 2007 from the National Security Space Office at the time about solar power satellites, and that attracted the attention of the leadership at NRL, and they turned inward to the scientists and engineers at NRL, the Naval Research Laboratory, and said, hey, is there something here? Is this all just nonsense? What's going on here? So we did a pretty intensive look at it over 10 years ago now and essentially concluded, yeah, you know, there's certainly physically, there's no showstoppers. Economics, of course, are going to be a bit more challenging. And there's still a lot of technological maturation that needs to happen. But certainly a capability could be constructed. So coming out of that, we did some basic, well, not basic research, but some prototyping for a sunlight to microwave converter, a sandwich module, for those that might be familiar with some of the specific space solar implementations. And we spent about 4 years developing that. We were the first to test a module of its type in space-like conditions under vacuum and solar illumination conditions. And I'm pleased to report that we should hopefully be, even this year, deploying a space experiment connected with that. So we're hoping to take that research further. In the intervening time, a lot of other interesting things happened as well. Another notable milestone was in 2016, I was fortunate to be part of a team for what was called the D3 Innovation Challenge. It was for defense, diplomacy, and development. And it was hosted by the U.S. Department of Defense Secretary at the time, Ash Carter, and the Secretary of State, John Kerry, who had invited submissions from all across the national enterprise to find ideas that had relevance in these three areas, defense, diplomacy, and development. And Pete Garrison invited me to be part of the team, and of over, I think, hundreds of submissions, we ended up ultimately making it to the final and getting the most awards. You can find the video on YouTube of that presentation. And that proved to be a bit of a turning point, because after that, we had attention of a lot of senior folks in government, and there was more resources that were put into this area, and one of the culminations of that has been a study that was released this past fall called Opportunities and Challenges for Space Solar for Remote Installations, which is freely downloadable on the Internet, and that is kind of the natural successor to the original study we did at NRL back over 10 years ago. So there's also been notable movement on the technology development. Also available from NRL's website, you can find a press release that we released back in October for a power beaming demonstration that we did back in May of 2019, which is particularly noteworthy for the fact that it was the largest amount of power sent over the distance that it was sent in a manner which was completely safe. And that's been a big deal, because one of the first questions that comes up when you talk about power beaming or space solar is people will ask, well, is this going to fry birds? And the answer to that question, of course, has to be no. So there's quite a bit of technology development associated with that. So that's kind of the quick sketch of how we got to be where we are today.
So for the hundreds of listeners and other people who want to see a shift to space solar power for part of our electrical grid and things, can you do a black and white and say, yes, it's plausible, this is a timeline, and yes, it would be economic, or what are the caveats in trying to be that concise with something that so many people wish were here today?
Yeah, I'll mention out of the gate, I have a general aversion to black and white sort of answers to things, because rarely in actuality are things black and white. And I think this is no exception. One, I think, good point of reference to keep in mind when you think about space solar as a possible grid source of energy is just think about terrestrial photovoltaics, right? So, like, you can look back even in, like, the 1950s, they were manufacturing solar cells. But it hasn't been until the last 10 years or so where ground-based solar has become a cost-competitive source of electricity compared to the alternatives, right? So, and that's a long time. So I think it's challenging to project how the technology is going to mature. I think there's no question that there is still quite a bit of technology that needs to be matured. That rate, the rate at which that happens, could be highly variable, right? You could have something like an Apollo moonshot type program where it becomes a national priority and lots of money and time and focus is put into it. Or you could have something which we've pretty much had for the last several decades, where it just kind of languishes and nobody does anything with it. So depending on which of those conditions is in place, it's going to really dramatically affect how soon you might see something.
So what has to change to make it a national priority? Otherwise, it will probably just languish like it does right now.
Some of it is literacy. Like, a lot of folks are unaware that it's even an option. If you tell people about it, they are surprised that it is a potential source of energy. They wonder why people aren't investigating it more. So part of it is just raising awareness. I think that's a big element. And then I think also space solar in particular has suffered from a sort of bifurcated way that folks approach it, right? So, like, I've talked to a lot of people who think of space solar as this sort of cure-all or, like, the salvation for civilization and for humanity. And I also talk to people who are vehemently opposed to it, right? So this makes it difficult, needless to say, to have a constructive conversation about what the actual state of the technology is and what needs to happen. So I think one challenge is bringing people to a sort of evidence-based perception of what the actual state of technology is and what needs to happen, what the challenges actually are. You know, it's fine, of course, to suspend disbelief, but you have to look at things realistically. And I think beyond the technology challenges, and depending on the implementation that's selected, there might be quite a few. There's also regulatory challenges, right? Like, if you're going to use microwave power transmission, which a lot of the prominent implementations propose, there has to be spectrum allocated for it, and the spectrum is pretty darn full. So there's a non-trivial amount of effort that would need to go into allocating spectrum. There's, of course, the orbital slots, what orbits these things are going to be in. So there's a lot of non-technical challenges as well that I think most folks just don't have a real solid, accurate picture of at this point.
The people that support it, I mean, they absolutely believe it's here and available now, at least in a remote area demonstration project. Is there any validity to that? Could you have a demonstration project that was actually online working, and could it be commercial?
You could definitely do a demonstration project. I mean, I think that getting to a demonstration project that doesn't have the threshold of economic viability to be met is going to be a lot easier, obviously. I mean, again, you can look at the photovoltaic example, where we were using photovoltaics on satellites even in the 1950s, right? The first NRL satellite Vanguard used photovoltaics, so that you could say, hey, there was a solar-powered satellite, right? But yeah, no, a lot of it is connecting people who are interested in developing the technology and who can find the utility with the resources. So it's true that for DOD, and what it, so you mentioned out of the at the front, I am an employee of the Naval Research Laboratory. People say, well, why is the Navy interested in space or in solar power satellites? And the fact is that DOD and the Navy and the Marines all need energy to do their jobs, right?
Right.
So there's no question, I think your listeners will find it uncontroversial to know that most of our energy still comes from non-renewable sources, right? We see a lot in the press about solar and wind and other new sources of energy. But the fact is the majority of our energy, both nationally and globally, still comes from non-renewable resources. So this is something that at some point is going to be a problem, right? You can say, well, you know, they're going to be around for a while, but the fact is whether our non-renewable sources run out in 10 years or 100 years, they are going to run out, and that is going to pose a significant problem for national security, for the economy, for all kinds of things. So clearly there has to be a renewable source that we can turn to. And there's been a lot of encouraging progress on terrestrial alternatives, definitely ground-based solar, wind, and the like. As I'm sure your listeners know, they suffer from intermittency, which space solar wouldn't. I think one of the bigger challenges for space solar is seeing where it fits into that kind of energy mix, right? So, like, DOD has a different sort of energy set of priorities because to keep our warfighters with supplies and keep them connected, we're constantly having to ship energy to them. And as we've seen in, like, our wars in the Middle East, often that's in the form of, like, a convoy of fuel trucks, which is vulnerable to attack and sabotage and all types of things. So there's a big attraction to the idea, like, well, what if we could just send in from orbit wirelessly energy in a way that would be much more difficult to attack and would be much easier to redirect when the situation dictates. So that's one reason the DOD has been following this. Obviously, if the capability could be realized, it could truly be game-changing. You could envision perhaps a future where if there's a country or a company that is able to do space solar in a cost-effective way, they could effectively become the electrical power utility of the world, right? Like they can send it wherever it's needed. They can turn it off if you don't pay the bill. So that's an enviable position to potentially be in.
Are we close to being able to do that with our military?
I think there's still a little ways out. Like, so the demo we did in May of last year was over several hundred meters, and it was several hundred watts. This was for laser. So I guess one important thing to realize about solar power satellites is I don't think that there is broad agreement on the best way to implement them. If you look at the ideas from the 1970s and the NASA and Department of Energy reports from back then, the thought was to use photovoltaics and use microwave power transmission. Now, certainly it can be done that way, but there's challenges because you need extremely large aperture sizes. That's the size of the antennas, depending on the frequency that you're using. You could also use lasers or some other optical means, which makes the size of the transmit and receive surfaces smaller. But there's kind of a flip side there, too, because now you have to worry about, like, clouds and stuff. So I guess because there are so many different technological solutions for how you can do this, and folks haven't coalesced really around some people think they have the best solution, but my assessment is that it remains to be seen because there's enough unknowns with the component technologies that it would be premature to say, like, well, we definitely should build it this way.
You have already a question from a listener by email. This is from Todd in San Diego. And he says, do you know the amount of money from the federal budget that is actually spent on solar power research each year?
You mean solar just in general or space solar?
Space solar. I think that's what he meant. I don't think he means ground solar. I think he means space solar.
Well, so I can say that there is not like a line item for solar power satellites that's been around for like years and years, right? Like there's not, it's not, it's been very sporadic, right? So like in the 70s and 80s, I guess the 70s really mostly, there were various programs that were funded. NASA had some programs under the leadership of John Mankins in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then there's been intermittent things since then, but there's, it's not at a level where there's like an office whose responsibility it is in an ongoing fashion. Like certainly we're trying to figure out how to make it fit in and where it is best suited to live. But like, it's not like NASA or a NASA division or something that's like the solar power satellite division of the government, unfortunately.
Here's another email question, Linda, and Linda's in Reno, Nevada. And she says, I'm not sure how long the current oil pricing debacle for fossil fuels is going to last, but I would assume the lower the price like we're seeing right now, the more difficult an economic case would be for space solar power. Is that true, or is there something that we would be missing in that type of off-the-shelf economic analysis?
Well, so I'm not an economist, but I'll speculate a little bit here. Certainly if alternatives are cheap and have few downsides, it's hard to compete with them. I want to point out that there's two instances for space solar that are worth considering separately. So one is the grid case, where it is an alternative to like a coal plant or a nuclear plant or a terrestrial-based solar plant. And the other is what we're talking about for DOD, where you have like a remote installation somewhere, maybe Antarctica or some remote mining colony or a military base, where they're already paying a lot more than like grid prices for electricity. So obviously the threshold for such a place, a more remote place, is going to be lower than for the grid. And I think even within the grid, like there's still quite a bit of variability, right? Like folks in Hawaii pay a lot more for electricity than we do on the mainland. And depending on what resources it might be competing with, the case can be different. With regard to oil prices, I think that's probably beyond my level of expertise to really answer in a meaningful way.
Hopefully it won't be long-lasting on oil prices, but, you know, who knows. I have another question for you that came in from Tim via our Space Show blog. So, listeners, you can read this. It's kind of along the lines of what I just asked from our other friend. How does the price drop in wind and Earth-based solar affect this? And what about the effect of potential fusion efforts? And what does that have for investment? I know fusion is about 20 years away, but the focus fusion pushed that always to just 5 years away. Lots of luck. But there is a new effort called Sapphire that has proven their device in the lab and is funding a phase to build a working product for sale, which I think would mean 1 to 2 years away to product, and you can believe that if you want to. They are also working with MIT, DOD, Lawrence Livermore on this and can remediate nuclear waste, transmute medicine, cheap clean energy. I think that this would kill space-based power for Earth use, and also it'll help me keep my weight down too, Timothy, just letting you know that that's in the mix too. You can pick up my sarcasm on the list of benefits, because how many years have I heard this with space tourism and with this and that? Everybody says it's going to do this, this, and this, and it doesn't do anything. So any comments about this and fusion or what he's talking about?
Yeah, fusion, I think, like space solar, has the potential to be civilization transformational, right? The joke about fusion, and I thought you were about to make it there, was that it's been 10 years away for the last 60 years.
Oh, right. So, well, I was implying that, yeah.
And I mean, I follow technical publications. My impression of fusion is that there is actual progress being made. Whether it will translate into a cost-effective means of grid energy, I think, remains to be seen. There's definitely been claims that things should be happening within the next few years, but as we've seen, fusion has been making claims for a really long time and has yet to deliver in a major way on those. So fusion investment, I think, is key just because the potential there is huge. I think for the same reason, space solar investment makes a lot of sense, because even if ultimately it doesn't work out or there's something that's better, like, it's hard to know that now, right? Like, if we had perfect foresight, life would be a lot easier. And the fact is, we just don't, right? So I think one thing to keep in mind about space solar is it does have one relatively unique advantage, right? So, like, if you're looking at a power source, you can evaluate it by a number of different metrics. Space solar would be clean, much like ground solar is. It would be constant, unlike ground solar, but like you could argue fusion would be. And then because space solar, as it's typically envisioned, is coming from satellites in orbit around the Earth, you have global coverage, right? So, like, if you build a fusion reactor or any kind of other terrestrial-based power source, it's going to be in that place, and you're going to need a grid to distribute it, right?
Right.
So the idea of solar power satellites is now you have something where it's more like GPS, where we can count now on the ability to have navigational information anywhere in the world, whether you're in the middle of the ocean, the middle of the desert, Antarctica, you're going to have GPS. It is conceivable that a solar power satellite system could be the same way, where no matter where you are, you might have access to power. It depends a lot on the specifics of the technology you employ. But nonetheless, this is something that is certainly in the realm of possibility. And then I guess the nice thing about space solar is, like, you're tying yourself to what is the largest source of energy in our solar system, right? Like, the sun is likely to be around for at least another billion years, and it is by far dwarfing any other source of energy in the solar system. So it's pretty secure investment to try to tap that in whatever way we can, whether it's using ground-based solar panels or space-based solar panels.
The last couple of years, we have heard a lot about the risk to the grid and to all of us through EMPs from rogue nations and things like that. Is space solar power vulnerable to an EMP?
It depends. So, fortunately, our space infrastructure has survived the solar events we've seen so far pretty well. If you look at historically the damage that's caused by solar activity, much of it has actually been to the grid and things on the ground, whereas our spacecraft have fared reasonably well.
Uh-huh.
Now, that said, we have a pretty short sample time, relatively speaking, right? So we've been putting up spacecraft since the 1950s. There was a solar event in the 1800s called the Carrington event.
Correct.
Which,
yeah,
by accounts of contemporary accounts, would likely have dwarfed anything we've seen so far. So I am not going to tell you that a solar power satellite that hasn't been designed yet and is using technology that I can't specify yet would be able to survive something like the Carrington event or something worse that might happen. But certainly if we're in that sort of situation, it's likely to have far-reaching effects for stuff far beyond our satellites. So, I mean, an interesting thing about the situation we find ourselves in this month is it's a test of our resilience, right? Like, if you go back 300 years and you say, well, what would the effect of the internet outage be or the grid going down? And, of course, there wouldn't be any because those things didn't exist. But we've added these points of vulnerability into our civilization and society, and those need to be carefully weighed, right? You need to think about what you're doing and figure out what vulnerabilities you're introducing with any new system. So while I think space assets have shown themselves to be robust in the face of solar activity, and they probably could be designed and tested to be robust enough, there's no question that you have to look at the entire system, as with anything.
So whereas the internet could go down off of conventional grid, if you were powering it with space solar power, it might be able to stay up in a really horrific event.
Yeah, it's definitely speculative because a lot of this is going to depend on details that we don't really have a good way of characterizing from a hypothetical situation. But I think that space weather is not a showstopper.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall in Renfro.
Okay.
And thank you for covering the Carrickton event. So I'll have to go backup question, and that is, would the geostationary space-based solar power interfere with any of the satellites in low Earth orbit?
Yeah, great question. And I think that's a good opportunity for me to mention that while geosynchronous orbit has been the principal focus for solar power satellite studies in the past, it is definitely not the only orbit that might be used. I think also worth noting, and actually my colleague Ian McNally wrote a fantastic publication on this, there's variations on geosynchronous orbit that haven't gotten as much attention, notably the geosynchronous Laplace plane orbit, which would not be equatorial like most of the orbits that the geostationary satellites use nowadays, but would actually require less station-keeping fuel and the like. So, but to get to your question, would satellites that were in lower orbits than a solar power satellite, whether it's GEO or something else, be affected by the power beaming? And this is a question which, again, is going to depend on the implementation, but I think that there's credible ways of dealing with it, right? So part of it's going to depend certainly on the modality of power transmission. If you have a microwave beam that's many kilometers wide, there's a higher probability that spacecraft might go through it. You, of course, could come up with some sort of system that would turn off the beam for a fraction of a second while a very fast-moving low-Earth satellite flies through it. It would be much easier with optical transmission to do that. If the diameter of the power beam is smaller, the odds that something's going to impinge on it at any given time are likely lower. So this is certainly something that needs to be paid attention to, and we did give it a bit of a treatment in our latest report. But again, I'd say that's not something that is a showstopper.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about is the newer satellites could all be designed to work with whatever we come up with. Design solves a lot of the problem. But we have a lot of legacy satellites that have been up there for a long time. First thing that comes to mind is Hubble Space Telescope. And it's kind of like, how do you work around those? That's the big problem, I think.
Yeah, again, I don't think it's insurmountable, right? We have a pretty complete catalog of active satellites. There's actually a lot of places on the internet where you can even find fantastic animations of live depictions of what's in orbit. So we know where these satellites are. We know within a reasonable degree of certainty where they're going to be in a reasonable period we know in advance where they're going to be. So I think that it would be possible to design a system that is not going to interfere or harm existing satellites, Hubble, Space Station, or anything else. So, I think it can't be ignored. It's certainly not a showstopper.
Thank you. A lot of fun.
Thank you, Marshall. Listener Marshall cleared our phone line, and if you would like to call us, it is 866-687-7223. And I have sort of a question for you. In Northern California, we have Pacific Gas and Electric providing our electricity, which is always in trouble for fires or this or that or whatever. And I don't know, you said Hawaii has the highest price for utilities in the country. I really think my PG&E rate is probably higher than Hawaii's, but I've not compared them. Would space solar power, if it were available, lower my cost of electricity?
So, I mean, it's theoretically possible. I feel like there's too many unknowns to really answer that in a meaningful way. Like, I don't think we would see – so space solar power – again, assuming it comes to fruition, we can overcome the technological hurdles. We definitely have models that suggest that the cost could be low. Like, I'll digress for a second, I'll mention that one of the things that folks focus on for the cost of space solar is launch cost, right? So a lot of people, understandably, have gotten very excited as they've seen SpaceX reusing their booster rockets and, like, looking to bring down the cost per unit mass of getting spacecraft into space. So that is definitely a big deal, but it's not the only cost component for solar power satellites. Another cost component is intrinsic in how much power you can get down per unit mass. So some of the stuff we did with the NRL work and the prototyping of the sunlight to microwave conversion module was to increase something called the specific power, and that basically means how much power can you get down per unit of mass, right? So you would, in a perfect world, you could get down 10 kilowatts for 1 gram of mass or something, right? So we obviously can't do that right now. But that is a good metric to look at to see when the economics might close and for what cases, right? So certainly, if we were able to do space solar for a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour, that would be likely to have a favorable effect on your electric bill. But it's speculative because we're certainly not at that point now.
Okay, so let me take it a step further. So, and again, I'm using PG&E as an abnormal, unusual, and probably wildly corrupt model, but that's besides the point. So we in Northern California behave like we're in Venezuela and lost power all the time for a three-month period due to PG&E cutting our transmission of power because their equipment was capable of starting wildfires. So if PG&E was getting power from space solar power, it's to get it to me and to other users. It still has to go through their terrestrial transmission lines, and they still would have, if they did nothing to modernize or fire prevention, they would still have the same fire risk and power problems of starting fires because they're transmitting that power to us. They're not beaming that power to their customers. So, or is space solar power transmission different than grid transmission?
Yeah, this kind of depends how imaginative you want to be. So certainly, the nearer term solar power satellite concept would be as you describe it, where you would have a receiving site that then, in effect, would act much like an existing power plant would now, right? So instead of having a coal plant, you'd have like a big ground receiver. There are certainly other concepts that envision being able to actually beam power straight to the end user. Those are certainly farther term. I think the tech maturation that needs to happen for those is farther off. I, again, don't want to rule them out categorically. I will put in a mention of Solaren, which some of your listeners may be familiar with as
we're
California-based company.
Yeah, we've talked about
it. Oh, yeah. Have they been on before?
Never responded to any of our invitations, but we tried, especially when the announcements were made that PG&E was turning to them to meet their state-mandated requirement of green energy, but we could never get anybody to respond to us.
Well, certainly worth checking out their website. And, yeah, they're one certainly of a group of different folks who have concepts that they're developing in an effort to try to do this commercially. That's, of course, less my focus than that of others, but worth watching, I think.
You have another caller wanting to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Welcome back.
Yeah, hi. Interesting show, Dr. Jaffe. I have lots of questions, so hopefully I don't want to dominate the show, but I'll try and get them all off. So the space solar power was the economic justification for O'Neill Colony. Gerard K. O'Neill was proposing to use solar power satellites as you know, house space settlement would be justified economically. Has that changed? Can we do this with robots now, or you know, will we need humans up there tending these? And you know, do the economics still work for space settlements?
Yeah, great question. So I am familiar with the outline of O'Neill's vision And I've, of course, seen, as probably most of the listeners have, the pictures of his cylindrical, huge space colonies. I think the trend definitely is towards using robots to do things rather than astronauts. I mean, we see this all over the place on Earth, where any repetitive task where you need someone that's not going to complain or get tired or need to be fed or need to go to the bathroom, you want to use a robot instead. I can tell you that there's been quite a bit of work in this area. If you look on the web, you'll see that Northrop Grumman recently has had great success with a craft, I believe it's called the Mission Extension Vehicle. They can actually attach to a geosynchronous satellite and extend its life. There's also work going on at NRL with DARPA in the program RSGS, Robotic Servicing of Geostationary Satellites, which endeavors to do sort of what we're talking about here, where right now, if you put a satellite in space and something goes wrong with it, you're kind of out of luck, unless it's like the Blue Moon case of the Hubble Space Telescope or something on the space station, right? But if you send a satellite to geosynchronous orbit right now and the antenna doesn't deploy or the solar array doesn't deploy, you're kind of out of luck, right? So we are putting together a early capability of robotic servicing, which then is sort of a logical predecessor to in-space assembly, where you would use robots to do in-space assembly. So, yeah, I don't think you need astronauts. I think, in general, if you can avoid having astronauts to do something, that's going to be better for everyone.
Okay, and then you mentioned using laser instead of microwaves for beaming the power. Is that really going to be feasible for military applications for deployments if it's unpredictable because of cloud cover?
It depends a lot on the architecture. Now, I'll mention that one of the things that has made optical transmission using lasers more attractive is the prospect of having a high-altitude receiver. Like if you put a receiver in the stratosphere that's going to be above any cloud cover, now the atmospheric attenuation and the tropospheric weather effects become much less of a concern. It does, of course, introduce secondary concern, which is, well, now you have the power in the stratosphere. What if you actually need it on the ground? And that's a fair point. I think that depending on the paradigms of force structures and what have you moving forward, you can say, like, well, you know, having it in the stratosphere is actually a better place to have it. So the big advantage for laser for remote installations is what I mentioned a little while ago, which is that the apertures are smaller. There's actually a second potential advantage depending on what part of the spectrum you use. So I've talked a little bit about safety, and it's worth knowing that the power density for between about 2 and 100 gigahertz for what is called an uncontrolled area, so this is an area like where you might just be walking down the street or going somewhere and not expecting there to be anything dangerous, is 10 watts per square meter. Now, that's a pretty low amount of power. That's definitely lower than, like, walking out into noonday sunlight. And even in a controlled area, which might be like an industrial processing facility or a power plant or something, somewhere where people are working and they expect that there's maybe something potentially dangerous, controlled area, the limit there is 100 watts per square meter, so 10 times as high as the uncontrolled area. But still, in the desert at noon on the sunniest day, you're going to be getting 1,000 watts per square meter. So that's still pretty low. Now, for space solar, you would envision being able to get this power, create this power density 24 hours a day rather than just that, like, few minutes of peak sunlight at noon. For laser power, if you look at the range of 1.4 microns to 10 microns, the safety limit is 1,000 watts per square meter. So that same level of the brief peak noonday sunlight that you could now potentially have 24/7. Now, if you get out of that spectral band, the safety limit goes way down because you have there's without getting into too much detail about the physiology of humans and eyes and skin and what have you, there's a range of different safety limits that come into play. So one thing for to kind of bring us back to your question about military installations, they typically don't have a lot of space, right? So they're not going to want to set up like a multi-kilometer receiving station in general. And if they can have a small receiver, that's going to be better. And the shorter wavelengths that you have with optical are going to be more favorable for that.
Next question. Video that's online on the D3 the presentation that you did online a few years back, it mentioned a $10 billion price tag for a system for delivering a certain amount of power. I don't know how much that was. Was that a gigawatt?
The D3 presentation was in 2016, so I'm not going to claim that I have perfect recall of everything that was mentioned in there. As I've been saying all along, there's a lot of tech maturation that needs to happen. I think that if you target a system that would be at the $10 billion level, you could achieve certain things, but there's enough that still has to happen with whether you choose microwave or laser or millimeter wave or something else. That's going to be very high level if you say, like, well, we should be able to do this. I think, hold on. It's coming back to me now. So I believe I said something like for $10 billion you could have a pilot system that could service the equivalent of something like 100 or 150,000 homes maybe. So and that mm-hmm. would be probably on the order of 100 to 150,000 watts or 150 kilowatts. And I have done analyses that suggest that that is possible, and I still think that that is in the realm of possibility, but it is preconditioned on this tech maturation I'm talking about.
Sure, sure. So I posted a entry on the blog regarding China's plans for space solar power, and they've got a very detailed timeline that lays out what they want to accomplish, and we know that they're committed to that based on previous history. Based on your introduction to the show, it doesn't sound like we have a concerted effort here in the U.S. For doing this beyond some of the stuff that you're doing. Does that concern you? Should we be concerned that China may overtake us on this front?
Yes.
I thought
we should.
So along those lines, the space demo that you talked about that's going to happen later this year, do you have a launch vehicle for that yet?
Yeah, so until that actually gets announced, I can't talk too much about it, unfortunately, but I would just say stay tuned. If folks are really interested in this, anything of note will be announced by NRL. You can go to NRL's website, www.nrl.navy.mil. NRL also does a pretty good job on social media for being a government organization. They've got a Twitter account at USNRL. And I also, for anything that NRL announces, I typically put out on my personal Twitter as well, which is at PJaffe. So for things that are coming up, I would say follow those, watch those, and you will be among the first to know. I will throw in another kind of upcoming thing of potential interest, and that is there's a lot you can do with power beaming just as an amateur, just kind of messing around with electronics yourself. If you look on YouTube, if you search for Lectenna, L-E-C-T-E-N-N-A, it's a portmanteau of LED and Rectenna, which itself is a portmanteau of rectifier and antenna. You can find videos of how, with just a few inexpensive components, you can play around with wireless power yourself. And I'll mention that there will be released soon from NRL interesting science, technology, engineering, math, STEM outreach video that addresses this. So keep an eye out for that if you're following these kinds of things.
Awesome. Final question. Anything that people can do just as space enthusiasts to help move this along?
Yeah, so I think the best advocacy that I have seen at the grassroots level has been through the National Space Society. So they have a concerted effort in connection with other space advocacy groups where they're engaged with the legislative process. They actually go to Capitol Hill and talk to Congress, and they have strategies and plans. So I would say definitely being engaged with the National Space Society is one way to help raise visibility for this. And then I know it sounds trite, but, I mean, if you talk to your elected representatives and raise the awareness of this, that also bodes well, because that means when they see a budget item and it says space, solar, power beaming, they're not like, what the heck is this? I've never heard of this. If you, their constituents, have already been writing them and saying, hey, you know, I'm concerned about America's future. I have kids. I know that our energy situation is not tenable moving forward. I want to see something done. I want to see the U.S. exert some leadership in this. I don't want the Chinese to be selling us their electricity from solar power satellites 20 years from now or whenever it would be. So a lot of it is just awareness raising. Like most, the average person has never heard of solar power satellites, doesn't know about them, has no idea of the implications of them, of the implications of power beaming technology. So a lot of it is just honestly getting the word out if you're a interested and concerned person.
Thanks very much, Dr. Jaffe.
Thank you, John, for your call.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay. Listeners, we're a little beyond halfway, and I'm going to pause us and take our break. And, Paul, we're getting kind of a squeaking sound every time you talk now. And I don't know if that came from John's phone line or is something with yours. But if it continues when we come back from the break, I'm going to disconnect and call you back and see if we can get a fresh phone line that doesn't do that. But let me do our break, listeners, and we'll pause. And I want to thank our sponsors, because we would not be doing this program without our great sponsor. So Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they are a leading global security, providing innovative systems, solutions, products for both commercial and government worldwide. And, in fact, we mentioned them a few minutes ago in our space solar power discussion. They have great capabilities and technologies from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. And the Space Foundation is another great sponsor. Unfortunately, they had to delay or postpone their symposium. Hopefully they can do it later in the year. It would be the 36th symposium. It's already always in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. I would suggest that you check their website to see if they're going to be able to reschedule it, spacesymposium.org. It's an incredible event. If you've never been to one, boy, you're really missing out. Astrox sponsors us, and they're involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than 30 years. Their proprietary codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze those designs. And their website for more information is astrox.com. AIAA sponsors us, and this is, of course, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's the world's largest aerospace organization, and they have multiple conferences, I think five big ones a year, and then regional breakfast meetings, lunch meetings, dinner meetings with speakers that you can attend. They have an incredible decades-going-back peer-review library on so many different topics. I used it extensively for my dissertation. That was back in 2000. It's probably unbelievably larger now than what I could access, and it was really huge when I accessed it in the late 90s to the early 2000s. You do not need to be an engineer to be a member, and check them all out at AIAA.org. In addition, we have Moonwords, and what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based that decision on technical and economic merit. Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will learn to play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Celestis sponsors us, and they are the global provider, the iconic global provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services. Remember, they have suborbital flights out of New Mexico Spaceport with Up Aerospace, and then orbital flights using the Falcon 9 at Cape Canaveral. They also have other flights that you can do, and they have a lunar flight coming up supposedly the fourth quarter of 2021. That would be their second lunar flight. And you can add a little bit of your DNA with a little bit of the ashes or DNA of your loved one and make the symbolic journey with your loved one. And go to Celestis, CELESTIS.com for more information. Speaking of the National Space Society, they sponsor us. They did have to delay ISDC for 2020 due to the COVID virus. I don't believe it's being rescheduled, but you can check the NSS website for that. But they do have their Space Solar Power Project. They have work on space settlement and lots of other things that are very close to all of us listening to the space show. So you can get to them easily. Just go to NSS.org or NationalSpaceSociety.org. The Integrated Space Plan sponsors us, and this is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another, explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website for all of this and more is thespaceplan.com, and you can also buy your own copy of the space plan. It comes in two different varieties. So all of this, again, is at their website, thespaceplan.com. Paul, welcome back. Are you with us?
I am. Hey, I'll mention real quick, hopefully this is obvious, but any companies or organizations I mention just do not imply, I'm not implying a government endorsement. And now that I've said that, I'll mention that I actually have a copy of the Space Plan for Students hanging downstairs in my house, which my kids really like.
I'm still getting that squeaky noise from you. Do you know what might have happened to your phone line, or should I maybe call you right back and see if we can eliminate it?
You know, I don't hear it on this end, so I'm not sure what the story is there. I am on our landline phone that I don't typically use, so it's conceivable that there's something in the receiver that I don't hear about.
Well, let me disconnect and call you right back. Listeners, stay exactly where you are, and we'll be less than 20 seconds probably. And I'll call you right back in just a second, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Listeners, hold on. Hopefully that will fix the problem.
David?
Yeah, are you there?
Yep.
I think we fixed the problem.
Okay, I picked it up on my cordless, which hopefully will maintain the battery.
Hopefully it should. Most of the people listening are probably more focused on commercial use of space solar power, or, you know, for grids or cities or something of that nature. How easy is it to transfer naval research lab work and DOD work to the private sector? Is there a lot of commonality? Does it benefit the private sector, or is it apples and oranges?
Glad you asked. Yeah, so we make a huge point to transfer as much technology as we can as it makes sense for the benefit of our nation. So kind of the classic example of this is actually GPS, which I mentioned before.
Uh-huh.
If you are familiar with the evolution of GPS, it's obviously today it's like a multi-billion dollar system that has countless benefits, especially with the smartphone integration. But it didn't start like that, of course. The technology needed to be developed from the beginning, which included being able to put precision timekeeping hardware in space, atomic clocks, and that didn't just happen magically. That actually was research that was done at the Naval Research Laboratory It was taking a room-sized atomic clock, making it small enough that it could fit on a satellite, making it so that it could survive in the hostile environment of space. And that was done. We actually built the first GPS satellite at NRL, and then once we had demonstrated the viability of the system, it was transitioned and now is produced by private industry. So that's the model that in many cases we try to work towards, where we retire the non-recurring investment, we do the research, we lay the groundwork, and then we transition it to either Navy, DOD, or national uses. So certainly the work that we're doing for solar power satellites could follow the same path. We have a number of advances we've made. We have a patent for thermal control for a solar power satellite conversion module. So all these things, I think, are potentially transitionable for a benefit for the nation at large and perhaps ultimately for a grid-providing solar power satellite system.
Okay, you have an email from Rick, who's also in Fremont, California. But first, listeners, our phone line is available if you want to call us, 866-687-7223. So Rick in Fremont, California says he's near the Tesla factory, so maybe some of Tesla's rubbing off on him. I don't know. Does capture of power in space assume photovoltaic cells on the satellite, or are working fluids driving a turbine at elevated temperatures, such as liquid sodium, part of the mix? The latter assumes, of course, mirrors focused on the fluid. Presumably the same could be done with photovoltaics. Are there other power capture mechanisms worth considering?
Yeah, so both of those have been considered. So photovoltaics is a whole, its own grouping, right? Like there's many different types of photovoltaics, silicon, gallium arsenide, multi-band gap cells, perovskites have been of great interest recently. Lots of different ways you do photovoltaics. Not the only way to capture the sun's energy. You could definitely use a heat engine. There's some really fantastic YouTube videos that show concepts for how this might work. People have also looked at solar pumped lasers, where the sunlight would directly pump a lasing medium to send an optical beam to the Earth. And there's even been proposals at various points in time for just using a reflector, just using a big mirror to direct sunlight at night or at dusk and near dawn time frames to send sunlight to existing solar arrays on the ground. So there's a lot of different ways you could do this. Like when I hear space solar, I just think taking sunlight from space and using it on the ground. So it could be any of these four different ways that I described.
Okay, and you have another caller. So, hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I was thinking. I think I may have been calling when you were actually giving me part of the answer to some of the questions I was going to ask. So you're talking about, I was going to ask the basic question of, you know, what the efficiency would be from turning solar energy in space into something would enter the power grid on Earth. I mean, how much loss would there be in that whole process?
This is a really common question. So definitely efficiency is something I think that is easy to gravitate towards because we understand it. But in a sense, you could think of almost any energy that we would get from a solar power satellite as almost being sort of, I won't say 100% efficient, but the fact is if we didn't intercept the sunlight, it might just go past the Earth into space, so it would be, like, effectively wasted, right? So if we were somehow able to capture even, like, a tiny fraction of 1% of that energy that otherwise we wouldn't be able to get at all, if we could somehow do it for low cost, then that would be a net benefit. And the efficiency is likely to be, I guess it's going to depend on a lot of different things, right? So, like, if you go to your hardware store and you buy a solar panel, like, you'll be doing pretty well if you find one that's 20% efficient or higher. But that's not going to deter you from buying it if what you're trying to do is power your off-grid vacation house or something that doesn't have a utility grid, right? Like, you won't care that you're only getting 20% of the energy as long as you have enough power to turn your lights on and do whatever you need to do in your off-grid place. So the efficiency is going to depend a lot on the power beaming methodology. It's going to depend a lot on the solar collection methodology. I think that an end-to-end efficiency that is going to be higher than 10% is going to be doing really well. As a point of reference, the most efficient that I'm aware of, anyway, power beaming demonstration, so this is totally separate from the photovoltaic collection or whatever solar collection means you might have, was conducted back in 1975. This was done at Raytheon. Bill Brown and his crew did a end-to-end 54% or a little bit higher end-to-end efficiency percentage of 54 from DC to microwave, transmitted across a room to a receiver, and then converted back to DC. So, and that was in 1975. So certainly for the power beaming, it should be possible to get tolerable efficiencies. And I think the bigger question really is the economics, like what cost per kilowatt hour is it going to result as? And the factors that go into determining that cost are two of the ones I mentioned before and then two other ones. So I talked a little bit about the launch cost, the cost per unit mass, the specific power, which is the watts per kilogram. Then there's the cost of the space hardware. That's going to be some dollars per kilogram. And then it depends how long the spacecraft can operate for, right? So if you just take these four factors, launch cost, cost per mass, specific power, and the duration of operation, and you put them all together, you end up with a cents per kilowatt hour figure. And if you have a spacecraft that's going to last for decades, then that cost just keeps getting lower, right? Or if you have something that has very high specific power, that cost can be quite low. So I think the specific power is actually more important than the efficiency. Kind of a long-winded answer, but hopefully you saw where I'm going with that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I get that. Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, the other issue that I thought was had been raised in some previous shows on this topic is the issue of the durability of these against potential micrometeoroid damage and things of that sort. That goes to the longevity issue that was you were discussing in a way.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that's likely to be much of a risk. So we already have spacecraft that have lasted for many decades. There's quite a large number of satellites that have been in service for greater than 20 years, some even longer than 30 years, and they've had to contend with the same thing, with the micrometeorites, the space environment, the solar activity. So the nice thing is, like, once you get into space, of course, depending on the orbit you're in, you have to make sure you're hardened against radiation and the like. But there's no vandals, at least for now, and there's no rain or hurricanes, really. So our existing space systems have demonstrated impressive longevity, and I feel pretty confident that if we built solar power satellites, it would be likely to be similar for them.
Do you think they could last maybe 30 years then, or 50 years, something like that?
Well, and you get into a situation where if they're serviceable, it becomes something that effectively has as long a life as you need, right? Like you can, if you can replace parts that are wearing out or that need to be upgraded, the platform is still going to be there, right? So you could just upgrade it indefinitely. It really becomes a question of the cost of doing that and whether the utility that you get from it makes sense.
Okay, and you were asking something about using laser instead of microwave as an alternative.
Yes.
But this, you're saying that these would be like solar pump lasers, or was potentially just using the solar light itself to do that? Or are you talking about something like electrical system?
You could do either. When I make a presentation, I have a chart that has what I call my postage stamp chart. So it's a single PowerPoint chart, and on it are like three dozen different proposed implementations for solar power satellites. So it includes the ones from the 1970s. It includes more recent ones. It includes from the Chinese, from the Europeans, from folks all over the world. Includes John Mencken's SPS Alpha. He, for those of you that are unaware of John, he actually wrote a book called The Case for Space Solar Power, which I recommend as a good in-depth introduction for folks wanting to learn more about this topic. So off another good book called Solar Power Satellites by Don Flournoy. No government endorsement implied or expressed here, just my own thoughts on these books. But yeah, there's lots of different ways these could be done. So for laser, you could either do solar pumping directly of a material that's definitely less mature, or you could just do a laser that's powered by a solar panel.
Okay, that's interesting technology, that's for sure. But really, it's going to come down to cost effectiveness of that in terms of launch costs. And you probably need to have reusable rockets like SpaceX seems to be on the verge of perfecting here to do this efficiently, I assume.
Yeah, I think what they didn't recover the last one, but that was like its fifth flight or something, so they're definitely showing that reusability is possible. Hey, one more thing about the efficiency that I didn't mention is we do a lot of things not because they are efficient or inefficient, but just because we need them. Like, most people, when they get in their car each day, they're not like, man, my car is sure inefficient. I guess I better not drive it that much, or I should buy a car that's more efficient. So at the end of the day, it really is about cost and utility rather than efficiency, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, if you obviously run out of alternatives or they are somehow unusable to you, then you have to do what you have to do, I guess. Huh? But, I mean, so I guess that's, well, I mean, the other, well, obviously, I think the chemical fuels that we're using now are going to be in limited supply ultimately. We just don't know what the total quantity is, and then there's always the environmental thing. So,
yep.
Is there any environmental issues with respect to this? I mean, I'm not asserting there are. I'm just wondering. I mean, since I usually come up with something.
Yeah, no, I don't see any of significance that are looming. So there's been studies that have said, like, well, if you're going to be launching rockets all the time, is that going to put stuff in the atmosphere that's going to negatively affect global warming? And the answer to that appears to be probably not. There's a question of if you're going to be taking all this energy that otherwise would pass the Earth and sending it to Earth, are you going to, like, start to heat up the Earth because you're putting more energy into a closed system? And the answer to that is also, it looks like that would be negligible, certainly compared to how the other ways that we might get energy instead. So I don't think there's I am not aware at this point of an environmental problem that would preclude trying to do this. Again, with the same caveat I've been repeating the whole time, which is that a lot of this really just depends on the specific implementation and how the technology is used.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, thanks a lot. Very interesting discussion. I'll leave clear lines if anybody else will ask you some questions.
Thank you, John.
Thanks.
So, listeners, John has vacated the line. If you would like to call us again, it is 866-687-7223. Barbara is in Tucson, and Barbara says, if we're beaming all of this energy down, I'm assuming there's a lot more beamed energy in the atmosphere than there is now. Is there any way to determine whether the additional amount of beamed energy coming down would impact humans as well as animals?
Yeah, great question. So this is something that has been studied in some capacity for a really long time, right? Because it used to be people were nervous about living near power lines or whether their cell phones or Wi-Fi or radio stations and whatnot was likely to be adverse to their health. And the prevailing consensus is that the answer is generally no. Now, there's a couple asterisks there because there certainly have been some epidemiological review studies that suggest that there may be some subtle effects that we don't fully understand. But in general, with non-ionizing radiation, which this is, and I guess for your listeners who might not be familiar with the distinction, so the electromagnetic spectrum is a continuum all the way down from DC up to cosmic rays. So your light and AM radio and FM radio and your Wi-Fi and X-rays and everything, it's all part of the same thing. And as the wavelength gets shorter, each photon has an increasing amount of energy. And once you get into, like, the UV part of the spectrum, the photon energy is enough to create an ion to, like, knock an electron out of a compound to ionize it. So for optical transmission and for microwave transmission, the energy in the photons is below the level that's needed for ionization. So an ionization is a mechanism that is often cited as introducing health hazards. So now that doesn't mean that if the power density is high enough, it can't be dangerous. You heard me talk earlier about these different limits that the IEEE has set, and there's other international organizations that set safety limits. So these things are pretty well characterized, and people know about them. You can certainly design a system that is going to be safe, that's not going to put a hazardous amount of radiation. And when I say radiation, it's not like radioactive. It means like the radiation from the sun or from something warm. So I don't think that that is a concern that is something that can't be addressed with prudent system design.
I have a caller on hold, but John in Fremont sent in an email. Is anyone working on spectrum allocation at this time, or is it too early?
It is definitely not too early. The only folks that have been doing a lot on this are actually the Japanese. My colleague from Kyoto University, Meiko Shinohara, has been working on this actually for a number of years, and there have been sporadic efforts in the United States. The organization that does spectrum regulation worldwide is called the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union.
Right.
And on the U.S. side, there's the FCC, of course, the Federal Communications Commission, and the NTIA. So it is definitely not too early. There have been companies for some of the consumer power beaming applications, like recharging your phone from a distance using microwave frequencies or using other parts of the spectrum. They have made forays into the regulatory side of this, but it is still, in my opinion, a much neglected thing, a challenge, a hurdle that needs to be overcome. So there have been kind of various efforts to work through this, and the process is extremely slow, right? So it's not like, so the thing I tell people is if we somehow magically had a solar power satellite right this moment today, this afternoon, like we couldn't turn it on because the spectrum is not allocated for it, assuming it needed to use microwave spectrum. So it's definitely not too early. People should be talking about that now. They should be engaged with it now. The challenge is that there's not someone whose job it is to do that. And I'm obviously coming from a research side rather than a regulatory side. So fortunately, it's not an area where I've been able to do a lot.
You do have another caller. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Aliza Shabaro. I actually know Dr. Jaffe, and I've been trying to follow the entire interview, but I've got disconnected a little bit. I just have a quick question. First of all, hi, Dr. Jaffe.
Hey, great to hear from you, Aliza. Thanks for calling.
So now that Space Force is sort of taking, like, it's starting to take off a little bit, are there going to be any changes within the Naval Research Lab, and is there anything that you can see happening in that with a new U.S. military branch and the Space Force and Space Solar?
Wow. Well, I really wish I knew the answer to that question, because I know that a lot of people are wondering about that. It's not clear what the impact of the standing up of the Space Force is going to be, whether we're going to get folded in with it or what. I think a lot of possibilities are in play. I haven't been following the latest on that. It could have a major effect, though, because it may influence the priority that's given to this. So, hey, I do have to digress for just a second, though. Aliza, you were the one who suggested using a bubble tea straw to hold the lectenna, and I really like that. I've been doing that a lot, and we're recommending that to people since it's a lot easier to get bubble tea straws to hold the lectennas than it is to get test tubes. So I give credit where credit is due. So again, for those of you who are interested in the hardware development aspect of this, if you go on YouTube and look for lectenna, you can figure out how to play around with microwave power transmission yourself and have some fun with that.
It is a lot of fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your call.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Livingston.
Thank you. I didn't catch her first name for my summary. Can you say it again for me, please?
Oh, Elisa.
E-L-I-S-A?
Yep.
Something like that. Okay. So here's an interesting political question. So George is calling from emailing from Atlanta, and he says, in the past, the science officer advisor serving the president has been presented with space solar power programs or projects, especially the National Space Society one many years ago when it was done when Obama first came to office. And he wasn't too interested in space solar power, so most likely not too much happened. I don't know of any other scientific advisory office for any president that has shown much interest in space solar power. They have their own scientific interest. And I'm wondering to what degree having the scientific advisor for the president on board for space solar power, is that essential to see us really move forward, or does it not matter?
I don't think it's essential. I think it would probably help. So as folks undoubtedly know, in our country, it is the Congress that controls the purse strings. And I think for the next meaningful steps to be taken, it has to come from funding to mature the underlying technology. Now, it's not going to hurt to have whole-of-government leadership, which could come from an office like the National Space Council or the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But really, without Congress allocating funding to help push the technology forward and to keep people focused on it, to keep our eye on the ball, so to speak, so something that as someone else mentioned, China does appear to be doing, both in the publications they're putting out and the plans they're publishing, certainly having interest and support at the highest levels in the executive branch, whether it's president, vice president, or whomever, I think would be helpful. And the nice thing about space solar is it really hits a lot of kind of bipartisan points, right? Like, you can look at it as an advantage from, like, a green energy standpoint. You can look at it as advantageous from a defense standpoint for energy, for military operations. And certainly there's a lot to be said for job creation for it, for reinforcing our military and industrial bases. So it really has, I think, a lot of bipartisan potential. It's funny, when we put out press releases in the past, they get picked up both on, like, Drudge Report and, like, Huffington Post, which generally are considered to be kind of opposite ends of the political spectrum. So there's clear bipartisan interest and support, I would say, for this kind of technology.
Years ago on the space show, I had a guest on multiple times. You probably know him or knew him. He's passed away recently or familiar with his work. And this was Dr. David Criswell over at the University of Houston. And he would advocate space solar power from the surface of the moon. Are you familiar with Dave's work and what he was talking about? Did you know him?
I am familiar with his work. I unfortunately don't think I ever got a chance to speak with him in person. I know I've read a bunch of his papers, and I honestly could never quite wrap my mind around his interest in using the moon, right? So the moon, granted, has some nice advantages in that there's a lot of materials there already, so you could build something there. But it is quite far away. It's a lot farther away than GEO, 10 times as far, just about. And it's not always in the same spot in the sky. So it gives up some of the advantages you have in geosynchronous orbit or in one of the lower orbits where the power beaming link would be lower. I could see a stronger case, I think, for using materials from the moon to build solar power satellites that are not on the moon. But building a power transmitter on the moon, I don't know. I couldn't really see the rationale for that exactly.
It never seemed to catch on, but he was really committed to that kind of an idea. And listeners, you can search his name and hear those old shows. And as I said, he passed away, I think, late last year. So we won't hear any more from him, but he was out there pushing it, that is, for absolute sure. Another thing I have heard listeners on the space show talk about, so you can say this is plausible or maybe in a million years or never, that space solar power should be publicly financed as a public utility, and then we can just grab the power without any cost other than maybe infrastructure we need on our homes or something, and we no longer need nasty, meano utility companies. So is there a personal usage of space solar power down the road that you see?
I would not rule it out categorically, but what you described is a lot more technically challenging than what's been considered to date. I will use that, though, as kind of a segue to talk about different ways that this could come to fruition, right? So I mentioned sort of the development of GPS, which was just the U.S. government, it's really the Department of Defense development. So it's conceivable that space solar could come to be through a similar type of effort where the government just says, you know, we're going to do this, and we see that it has utility, and we're just going to do it, right? And then, as in the case of GPS, maybe it would be then used for civilian purposes later on. You could also look at something like the way communication satellites evolved, right? We had in the 60s, as people saw increasing activity in space and the prospect of using satellites for communication, not only did the government invest in the technology, but they also put the framework in place so that private industry could take maximal advantage, right? We had the Comsat Act and the Comsat Corporation, Intelsat, and now space's largest industry is satellite communications, and that was largely because of the foresight of folks in Congress in the 60s that saw the potential here and created the framework. So my friend Daryl Preble has promoted a Sunset Act, which would do something similar for solar power satellites. You could also look at kind of mega engineering projects like the International Space Station or the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, also called ITER, which is in France. And these are two examples of where countries from around the world join together to share the costs and the benefits of an exciting technology or an exciting capability. In the case of ITER, it's for fusion energy. And it's notable that if you look at ITER, the folks that are participating in it are not just the United States, European Union, but Russia, China, India, Japan, South Korea. I think you'd be hard-pressed, other than maybe the Olympics, to find an instance where countries from such a broad swath of the world are working together collaboratively on something. And it's because, in that case, the tremendous potential of fusion energy. So I think a similar opportunity exists for space solar, and I know that there have been countries around the world that have toyed with the possibility of trying to start up an ITER equivalent for space solar, but we haven't seen that just yet.
I have another email. I know we're also getting short on time. So John in Fort Worth said, what about a solar power pump, Maser, M-A-S-E-R? Is that a feasible technology that should have the advantage of simplicity of solar pumping and microwave frequency for penetrating the atmosphere?
I've read a couple papers on that. It definitely seems intriguing. It strikes me as still being at a relatively low technology readiness level. I don't know if you guys have talked about that with much frequency on the show. But there's a scale of technology readiness.
Yeah, we use it all the time. So,
okay. So, yeah. So I would say that it's an interesting prospect, but it's still pretty low TRL.
I have one more question, and then I'll ask you to summarize, because I know I promised you 90 minutes, and we're pretty much there. Jack is in Portland, Oregon, and he said, in the first part of the show, you were asked if we should be concerned about the innovation and the work of China in this area and the lack of same in the United States. And you seem to indicate, or did say, we should be concerned. So I'd like to ask you if the current analogy might be useful to put this concern in order so that people can talk about this to their elected representatives and try to raise awareness. The current example I'm using is that we have allowed China to pretty much control our prescription drug and a lot of other industries. And now we're having shortfalls for various reasons, probably some of them political, and we're up the creek, and maybe up the creek unless we can get supplies from China. If China comes forward and does get space solar power, could we be vulnerable to China in some way because of their ability to have space solar power, much the way we are now really vulnerable to China because we don't control prescription drugs and other key elements that we need for our own country?
Yeah, certainly. So I don't have great familiarity with the example used there with the prescription drugs, but certainly, again, to go back to GPS, like, the U.S. was first with GPS, but other countries recognized that they did not want to be beholden to the U.S. should we deny them use of GPS, right?
Right.
So the Russians, of course, have GLONASS. The Chinese have Beidou. The Europeans have Galileo. They all saw that they did not want to be vulnerable in the way that they could be if they depended on the U.S. solely for GPS. And I think we don't want to put ourselves in a position where we are dependent solely on another country for anything, whether it's prescription drugs or energy or what have you, right? So there's a lot to be said for maintaining a strong national industrial base, strong domestic capabilities in a variety of things, whether it's electronics production, pharmaceuticals, or what have you. And there's so many good economic reasons, right? Like, obviously, doing anything that has these high technology dividends creates jobs and creates a broad industrial base, requires an educated workforce. There's a lot of supplementary benefits that you reap when you try to make a system like this domestically.
One can only hope that people can help raise the awareness of people. Do we need to wait? Because they say there's no economic case for this, so we're going to table it. Can we make progress? Can we move forward? Can we get closer to something that's real while there isn't really economic viability on the commercial side? Do we have to wait to make the business case?
So until the technology matures, it's going to be a lot harder to even come up with like a detailed picture of the business case. So one thing we did in the recent study is we looked at a number of metrics to see how close the business case was and what would have to occur for you to get to a point where the business case might be made, right? And these included a lot of the four things I already mentioned about how you would calculate the rough cost, the cost of putting things in space, the specific power, how many watts you can get down per kilogram. And really, the focus right now should be on making the investments in the technology that push the envelope on these metrics, right? So right now, I mentioned one historical example of power beaming in 1975, the high-efficiency one that was done at Raytheon. There was a second really notable power beaming demonstration that was done in 1975 at NASA's Goldstone ground station, one of the Deep Space Network nodes that folks may be familiar with in California, where Bill Brown and Dick Dickinson were part of a team that beamed 35 kilowatts over about a mile. Now, they did this using a very large dish and array of Rectenna receivers, and that remains today the longest distance, highest power beaming demonstration that has ever been done anywhere in the world. That was 45 years ago. So if we want to push the technology on this, like, we need to be investing at the component level, doing demonstrations, doing things at the system level to show that the technology is actually advancing. Like, if you wanted to try to do that same demonstration today, it would take probably at least a year, because you're starting not exactly from scratch, but like pretty close. And a lot of the technologies have evolved, so you could theoretically do it even better than it was done back then, but we just haven't done it.
Have we missed anything that you think we should have talked about today or that you would like to bring to our attention?
I think we've covered it pretty well. I would urge people, like, I think 2020 is going to be an exciting year for power beaming and space solar. I think you'll see a number of announcements in the next couple months. So for folks that really have a passion or an interest in this, I would again ask that they take the time to look at NRL's website, www.nrl.navy.mil, follow NRL on Twitter, at USNRL, and like I said, anything for space solar in particular, I don't tweet that much, but if there's anything notable that comes out, I do say something about it, and I'm just at P. Jaffe. So, yeah, I think while there's reasons to be concerned, there's also reasons to be optimistic, and I think that the biggest influence that people can have is raising the awareness, like talking to their elected officials, talking to their friends and neighbors, at least for now, from a appropriate social distance, and just, yeah, getting this idea out there. Like, the idea is not in the larger consciousness right now.
So you don't see our virus problems as particularly slowing anything down for 2020 then, I take it?
Well, I don't know. We'll see. Like, right now, I've been working from home for a little bit, as I suppose a lot of folks have been, and I'm grateful for that. I've also spoken with a lot of folks who, unfortunately, are not working and who have been laid off because of conditions created by the virus. So we'll see. I'm definitely still optimistic about 2020, and it may affect our timeline, but hopefully not too much.
I have one 11th hour question from Terry in Dallas, and he says, is space solar power your exclusive work, or do you do other work at NRL?
Now, I do all kinds of stuff, so it's definitely an area that I've spent a lot of time on recently, but it is not my exclusive area of expertise, interest, or activity.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for being with us, and I hope we can turn to you and talk to you down the road, because I think we'll be with Space Solar Power and talking about it for a long time to come. So we appreciate your being here, and if you ever think of something that you want to call to our attention, let me know, and we can put it up on our blog or do a program about it or at least tell people about it.
Certainly. David, thank you for the opportunity. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for today, and we appreciate those of you who participated with us. And look at the newsletter. Our next live program is Tuesday. And then we're back on the regular schedule, Tuesday, Hotel Mars on Wednesday, Friday, and then another Sunday Space Show program. And all of that is already prepared on our upcoming show menu and our newsletter, which goes out early tomorrow morning. And we thank Dr. Jaffe for being with us, all of you who called. And everybody stay safe. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, whatever you're doing. And we appreciate your being with us. Goodbye from Paul, David, and the Space Show.